Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anna's Owl Ministries podcast.
You don't choose the things you believe in. They choose you, according to Lamar Burgess in Steven Spielberg's 2002 film Minority Report. Today, we're going to find out what beliefs chose us about justice, redemption, the future, and more. And I say we. I am myself, Emmanuel Walsh, and I'm here with TJ and Kevin, regular hosts of the Systematic Ecology podcast. And we have a special guest with us today, Thomas J. Ord. I'm going to give you a little bit of a bio about him. He is a theologian, philosopher, and scholar of multidisciplinary studies. He's a best-selling and award-winning author, having written or edited more than 30 books. And as a personal plug, The Uncontrolling Love of God was personally significant for me. He directs the Center for Open and Relational Theology, and he is known for his research and writing on love, open and relational theology, science and religion, evil and power, and the implications of freedom and relationships for transformation, which is why we've asked him to discuss this film about destiny and choices. Welcome, Tom. Do you want to say a little bit more about yourself and also anything you might be geeking out on these days?
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to this discussion, and this particular movie, I think, is going to spark some great dialogue. What am I doing these days? I'm still directing doctoral students in open and relational theology. I'm writing a systematic theology. Actually, it's a systematic theology of love, and I'm posting the chapters on Substack. So if folks are interested in that, they might check that out.
Pretty cool.
Excellent. And TJ, what are you geeking out on these days?
The new Dying Light game, Dying Light the Beast. It's so good. A true successor to the first game. It's phenomenal. Been having a great time.
Awesome. What sort of game are we talking about?
Oh, zombies.
How did I not know that?
Oh, yeah. It's phenomenal. It's so fun. It's such a good time. Go dropkick a few, make a new weapon because it broke, dropkick some more zombies. There's a little parkour in there.
Awesome. Good time. And Kevin, how about you?
So I saw the new Paul Thomas Anderson film the other day, One Battle After Another. It is amazing. I would say as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, go see it on the biggest screen as soon as you can. Leonardo DiCaprio, Tiana Taylor, Sean Penn, Benicio del Toro. It's a big action war epic, but also a very timely satire. I loved it. I thought it was one of Anderson's best. And I'll talk about it more in the future if I can get some other hosts of the show to watch it. There's a lot to dissect in that film, but all I can say right now is go see it.
Yeah, I've seen like an absurd number of people saying, hey, I saw this in 70mm IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
Wildest film experience of my life.
I guess I forgot to do my geek out thing, too. I apologize for that. My geek out's probably going to date me, but I went to see Spinal Tap 2. What was it, last week or so? Spinal Tap 1 came out my senior year of high school. That's how old I am. So we're talking 40 years ago. And it was, the lines from that movie were lines said over and over in the punk bands that I was in college. And so I went and saw the sequel, and it was good. It wasn't, awesome, but it was good.
Yeah, I need to check that out.
Yeah, I will admit that I also went and checked that out. I'm still kind of reeling about the fact that there was both, fart jokes and a joke about Karlheinz Stockhausen. It is rare to find a film that combines those two niches of humor. So let's take care of a little bit of business. So we are the Systematic Geekology Podcast, not to be confused with Tom's Systematic Theology. And we would be happy for you to subscribe, rate, and review us anywhere that you can do that. We also want to give a special thanks to mutual friend of the show and of our guest, Trip Fuller, for his financial support, and remind you that you too can get a shout out by supporting our show for $5 a month on our new Fourth Wall site. The link should be in the description for wherever you got this show. And you can get extra content there, like the bonus question to this episode. We'll be talking about the movie's predictions of the future. You can buy merch, and you can leave a one-time financial gift there, as well as signing up for regular donations, or regular contributions. All right, so that takes care of paying the bills. Let's get into the movie. So I believe that, Kevin, you were going to give us a little bit of a plot summary for the film. Why don't we start there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are talking about Minority Report, the 2002 sci-fi action thriller directed by Steven Spielberg with a screenplay by Scott Frank and Don Cohen based on a short story by Philip K. Dick. If you've not seen this movie, please go see it and then come back and listen to the podcast because we're going to get deep into spoilers and themes and everything. It is, a 20-year-old movie. So, you know, it's if you're, you know, worried about spoilers, you know, you may have been missing out. But this film takes place in 2054, and there is a special unit of division of police called pre-crime, which predicts crimes before they happen. So in the opening scene, Tom Cruise, who plays John Anderton, one of the officers, they use precogs to have visions of would-be criminals. And in the opening scene, they go and stop a man who would have otherwise killed his wife and her lover. And so this sets the stage. The pre-crime has been in existence for, I think, a couple years at this point. And John Anderton is one of the main officers. And his backstory is that his son went missing years earlier when he was at a swimming pool with them, and he had taken his eyes off for 1 second, and his son went missing. So this threw him into, crisis mode, and the concept of pre-crime really appealed to him, because if he could prevent something like this from ever happening to anyone else, he would. So that kind of sets the stage. Meanwhile, there is a federal agent played by Colin Farrell who is investigating the pre-crime division to see if it's legitimate or not, because at this point, it's only operating in Washington, but the director of it wants it to go national. And things really kick off in the movie when John Anderton finds that he is one of the people that a precog predicts he will be a murderer. And so he is set up as a criminal. He is under impression that there's no way this could be true, because when he sees the precog vision, he doesn't even know the man that he is supposedly destined to kill. So he goes on a detective case to try to clear his name and figure out what's really going on. A sequence of events plays out from that point on. And eventually we get to the climax that when he does come into contact with this man that was in the vision, it looks as though this is the man who kidnapped his son years earlier. And that's what propels him to potentially kill him. But ultimately, when the moment comes and he's in a hotel room and he's about to gun the guy down, he chooses not to and arrests the man. However, this man ends up still dying because the whole thing turned out to be he was hired by someone to pretend to be this, kidnapper and the man responsible for the disappearance of John Anderton's son. And so and he claims that if he doesn't carry through with this, then the people who hired him are going to kill his family. So he then falls out the window of the hotel, kills himself. This then propels John into the climax of the movie, which he finds out that the leader of pre-crime, played by Max von Sydow, is actually set up everything as this big conspiracy. He is the one who orchestrated the murder of Agatha's mother, Agatha being the main precog here. And so in the final act, John works to expose Max von Sydow's character and expose pre-crime, and eventually pre-crime is dismantled, and you know, John and his ex-wife go and live in peace, and also the precogs are freed and they live a peaceful life at the very end. So that is a little bit about this movie, but we're going to get much deeper into it in this discussion.
Sure, yeah, thanks. So, and just for a little bit of context, you know, I was thinking about, you know, this movie came out for me a couple of years after I graduated from college, still pre-kids. So, you know, I was very much in the audience for, you know, a kind of high concept, trippy, hard sci-fi story. Steven Spielberg was kind of at the peak of his powers, I would say, had a big run of movies in that 90s to 2000 period that were just hit after hit. And so his name was a big draw. And it also seemed like there, you know, hard sci-fi was kind of having a moment. The Matrix had come out a couple of years previously. We were 10 years after things like Jurassic Park and Terminator 2. And so there was that kind of sense that we finally had the technology to realize any kind of visual storytelling they wanted to about the future or alternate technologies, things like that, that you could put anything on the screen now. You're only limited by your imagination. And so I think we kind of saw from that a boom of these kind of hard sci-fi kind of stories. And so, you know, I was hooked. I was excited about it. I was there to see it in the theaters when it came out, and along with a few other people. And, you know, I think it has lived on as a hit from that time. But how about everybody else? You know, either your memories of seeing the film for the first time or your current impressions, maybe you got to revisit it recently.
Yeah. So for me, when this came out, I was really excited to be turning 3 years old. So it came to me much later in life. When I was in college and like really getting into, like, by the time I was, you know, 15, 16, like good sci-fi movies didn't really come out anymore. It was all horror or sci fantasy. So I was having to go back and like find old science fiction gems like Total Recall, this. I used to get Minority Report and Total Recall mixed up in my head because I'd never seen either one of them. I had to fix that. So for me, the first time I saw it, I was kind of amazed because just watching it and seeing how much of the technology, which in 2002 was just completely unfathomable, just exists now and did. Like when I watched it, like when specifically when Anderton, Tom Cruise, is interfacing with the temple, or, you know, messing around with the screens and the gloves he's wearing, those, like, I saw those and immediately I was like, oh, those are the gloves that Imogene Heap uses to write music, which is also awesome. They're called Mimu gloves. Super cool. Super, super cool. She has a Tiny Desk concert where she explains it. Check that out if you've never seen it. Amazing technology. And it's just funny to see how much of the stuff that they're doing in that movie has actually just come into fruition. Like, you know, touchscreen surfaces, multi-touch screen surfaces, gesture controls. Super dope. Super cool for me to watch as a young adult, closer to the future than they were.
Well, and like TJ, I was also a kid when this movie came out. I think I was about 8 then, so I also did not get to see it in theaters. This is one I would love to see in theaters at some point. I think I first discovered it, though, when I was probably late middle school or early high school. I think I remember distinctly watching it on a road trip and on the TV there. And I, if I'm not mistaken, I think I got it as a rental from Netflix back when Netflix was doing, before Netflix was a streaming service, when it was doing the send you a DVD in the mail system. That was how it used to work. And I believe I got it then, because I still remember, even as a kid when the movie came out, seeing the trailers, but it was also maybe not quite appropriate for me at the time, or I don't know if I would have understood it as much. And so, but I really fell in love with it when I did see it, you know, probably in sometime in my adolescent years. And yeah, I was just mesmerized by, like TJ said, this was a big moment for digital effects. And but also, it's just such a smart screenplay. And this was an example of a movie that really combined good writing with spectacle and with, you know, big action sci-fi sequences. So I loved it from the moment I first saw it. And it's one that is very rewarding on every watch. So really excited. But Tom, what was your earliest memories of this movie?
I'm pretty sure I rented this from Blockbuster when it came out. But then I watched it again just last night, so it's very fresh in my mind. When I first saw it, I was very disappointed in it. I didn't like it. Well, I shouldn't say it that strongly. I liked the fact that it was dealing with metaphysical issues like the nature of time, questions of free will, questions of moral responsibility, epistemology, those kinds of things. But it presupposed a view of time and God, I think, that I strongly reject, which is probably one of the reasons I'm on this conversation today. And so at that time, I didn't like it. When I watched it again last night, there were still things I didn't like, but I had a much deeper appreciation for it. So I think it does a great job of posing crucial questions that theologians like me are asking and trying to answer.
Well, that seems about as good of a setup as we're going to get for. Why don't you take a little detour and tell us a little bit more about your theological views and framework that puts you maybe at odds with the structure of the film or the metaphysics of the film.
Thank you all so much for your time listening to this episode. If you want to help sponsor our show, but you can't quite do the membership thing, commit to that once a month payment, good news, you can leave a donation on our Fourth Wall website. You also can get some free content over there. So if you don't have the money for the membership, but you still want to hear some of the extras and bonuses we do over on Fourth Wall, there's an option for that. If you want to support the show without that commitment every month, again, you can donate over there. Every little bit helps. You know, our show has a lot of needs when it comes to equipment, when it comes to going to some of the events we want to go to, advertising, getting the word out about our show. It takes a lot, and we really appreciate each and every person who's able to help us do it, even if it's something free, just like the free membership or leaving a rate and review on our site. Every little bit helps. Your time listening to this helps, and we appreciate all of you. We're so proud of the community we formed over at Systematic Ecology, and we're very happy and we're proud that you're a part of it. Thank you so much for your time and for being a part of this community.
Sounds good. I think I'll contrast myself with Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, Roman Catholic theologian, probably the most influential systematic theologian in Christian history. He and many others in the not only Christian tradition, but Islam and Judaism as well, have thought that in some way God is outside of time or timeless. And because of that, God not only knows what happened in the past, what's happening in the present, but God can know with 100% accuracy everything that's going to happen in the future. In fact, Thomas Aquinas, and I think this is especially appropriate for this movie, Thomas Aquinas often talks about God seeing the future. So it's a visual metaphor of God's knowledge of what's going to happen. Of course, in this movie, you have three individuals called precogs who somehow can see videotape footage of what's going to happen in the future. And that seems very similar to what maybe Thomas Aquinas might have had in mind. I, however, reject that view of God and time. I don't think God knows the future with certainty. I don't think the future is capable of being known because it's not, doesn't yet exist. So I think God knows everything that happened in the past, everything that's happening in the present, and all possibilities for the future. But again, God can't know the future, in my view, because there is no future yet to be known. The reason I believe this, there's actually several, but one of them has to do with the questions of free will and moral responsibility, which I'm sure we'll get to. Should I stop there as sort of a way to launch into things?
I think that's a good, that sets the table well, or that gives us a good kind of context for where you're coming from. Yeah, does anybody else have any thoughts that they want to add there to your own perspective on these issues or your own background on the topics of time and free will and so forth?
No, I feel like this kind of movie is kind of amazing just because it gives you the opportunity to think about these things deeply. And if you don't want to do that, you can just sit there and be like, oh, man, that's Tom Cruise. Look at him run. That's the Tom Cruise run. look at him go. But really, just impressive, super impressive film, especially be based off of a novella, adapting not that much content into a movie this long and well-made. I just feel like needs to be mentioned before we get pretty deep here in a couple minutes. So,
oh, I agree with TJ in that that's what I love about this movie so much, is that it does such a good job of the action spectacle, the characterization, the story, this blend of sci-fi noir, and, you know, has this mainstream appeal, but it asks these deep questions, whether you agree with the ideas or not. I like that it is not a, you know, it just, you know, it could have easily, I think a lesser screenplay could have just thrown out this concept and be like, okay, cool, and then just done a bunch of crazy action sequences and had Tom running around all the time. But it takes all of those elements and really strains it. It's always grounded in the characters, in the story, in the exploration of themes and ideas. And yeah, I don't know. Do we want to go ahead and get into kind of, because I know, Tom, you just brought up some really big points about the movie's notion of free will. And I can say a little bit about, I guess, my background there, because I mean, there is so much to think about with this film.
Well, I think before we go there, I'd like to say one other thing about this film, and it's sort of what makes it, I think, a little bit different from a lot of sci-fi movies. Maybe you guys can correct me, because you probably know the genre better than I do. But a lot of sci-fi movies that explore questions of time explore the possibility of going into the past and somehow altering the past to change the present. You know, maybe one of the best known is Back to the Future, right? Huh. Goes back in time, and now they have to do things so that the present is going to be a particular way. And that, as always, you know, always raises really difficult questions, like, really, can you go in the past? And if the past is affected, then how is that going to be in the present? And if you made a decision in the present to go back in the past, isn't that a decision in the present already determined by the past? And all these kinds of really difficult questions. But what makes this movie, I think, different from at least a lot of sci-fi movies I've watched, is it's not talking about returning to the past. It's somehow thinking about knowledge of the future and how knowledge of the future can be determinative for, in this case, the moral responsibility of the people involved, people about ready to commit murder, apparently. So I think that's a little bit of a twist. Am I wrong about that? Are there lots of other movies that talk about the future, knowing the future? Am I wrong about that?
I think you're very correct for the most of it. I mean, there are a lot of type of movies that are obsessed with time travel and they have these debates about, you know, oh, if you go back in time and you alter something, does that create an alternate future? But right. But yeah, there are, there's not, and especially at this time, I think, like, this was a unique one in that respect that explored visions of the future. And it also emphasizes in the movie that they are still imperfect. And that's why Colin Farrell's character is critical of the pre-crime division, because he says there's no degree of certainty here. It's still, even if there is a 99% chance that this person is going to commit murder, there's still that, you know, a chance of what if they decide not to go through with it, and how do you deal with the ethical ramifications of that? And so, I don't know, Andy, if you have any, but yeah, when I think of sci-fi movies that deal with time, so much to do with time travel, and even if they travel into the future, it's still, you know, like, I don't know, it's dealing with time travel. This isn't really a time travel movie. It's relating to what if we had the technology to look into the future, and how would that impact, you know, law enforcement? So I think it's very unique in that respect.
Yeah, the only other film that comes immediately to mind is Arrival.
That's a good one. Yep, great movie.
If anyone's not familiar on the podcast or at home, it involves contact with aliens who have perhaps an experience of time that is more similar to the one that Tom was describing, ascribing to Thomas Aquinas. Right? They experience all of their lifetime as a single moment or simultaneously, or in some sense, they have access to the entirety of their lifetimes at all times in a way that perhaps we, and the movie kind of highlights this, right, that we might not really have the right words to understand that experience because it is such a different kind of experience. But as a result mm-hmm. of that, the movie does get into the concept of sort of retrocausality. Can events that have happened in the future have some impact on the past, which I think is the flavor of what you're getting at with the fact that, you know, these murders that have not yet been committed yet somehow cause people to wind up in prison. right? And so yeah. And how does that work, and is that just, and so forth?
It is interesting because the film at the same time opposes Tom's viewpoint, because it is at its core, you know, we find out later that it is all happening because someone manipulated the past, but when it was still the present. So not really, but it does still relate to the past. And then I feel like most sci-fi properties that do travel into the future and actually deal with that it's just been relegated to video games, because it's just something that you don't want to spend, you know, part of your 2.5 hour runtime of a movie on a video game where you're supposed to, you know, spend 20, 40, 60, 100 hours with it. Studios are a lot more likely to take that risk and sideline you there in the future of a past that you created, like in Final Fantasy 13 does that a lot, I know. But that's kind of a niche pool for most of our audience, I think. But Minority Report is interesting because it's just assuming that the future is correct. And that's part of Tom Cruise, John Anderton's, you know, role in the film is proving that wrong, along with Agatha's help, is just because they saw it does not mean it's going to happen. But
yeah, and I think that, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, Kevin mentions that too. And I think that's one of the places the movie is disanalogous to the theology of Thomas Aquinas and others, insofar as Aquinas and others who think that God knows the future also think God can't make any mistakes about that. It is infallible. Whereas in this movie, you start the movie thinking it's infallible, but then it turns out there's the Minority Report. There is another way of seeing things. And these precogs don't all agree. And in fact, by the time the movie's ending, you even have people making choices that go against what the precogs saw in the future. So they're obviously not infallible. So that's one of the differences, I think, in this movie from the theological notion of divine foreknowledge.
And do we think that that is an epistemological issue, right? That just these precogs have an imperfect knowledge of a set future, or is it an ontological issue that the future is not as set as is implied by those visions?
Yeah, I don't think the movie resolves that question. In theology, I can't think of anybody who believes that God's knowledge of the future doesn't also entail the ontological fact that the future is the way God knows it to be. So, you know, God's knowing and the future being the way it is, that's infallible. Of course, for us, that's maybe another question. But ultimately, I think a lot rides on this issue of whether or not the future is settled ontologically, if it's a fact, if it's a final state of affairs, if it's fixed. And someone like me, well, I won't say someone like me, I don't think that anyone, God included, can be absolutely certain about the future unless that future is settled, fixed, determined. But if that future is settled, fixed, and determined, then that seems contrary to free will. If free will is making choices amongst possibilities and one could do otherwise. So that's where the tension arises in the movie and in theology. If God knows the future and God can't be wrong about that, the future must be settled, but a settled future seems to be incompatible with us freely choosing among live options.
Right, which is my problem with your point of view, because I just don't, you know, you and I just don't agree on what time is. Because that's all that we disagree on is I don't believe time is constant.
Just a small matter like that.
Something we can ignore.
That's right, yeah. I would say, I guess we are debating. Yeah, I would say, TJ, that you live your life like I do, that time is real, that the future is a realm of possibilities, the past is settled. The way you live your life suggests you think time is real. But I could understand that for philosophical reasons or theological reasons, you might want to make the argument that your living as if time is real just might not be true about the ultimate state of things. Again, I don't agree with that, but I could I know people who make that argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because I'm just a man.
As am I. Yeah, I definitely don't want to claim to have this all figured out, but I do want to claim, just to be ornery, TJ, that my view makes a lot more sense of life and of God and of Scripture. How's that for putting down the gauntlet?
Nothing I haven't heard before. That's just normal Tom stuff.
That's right. I love it.
I think now you've said that on both of my shows.
So. You have, however, on your side, the majority of the thinkers in the Christian tradition.
Right.
Who? Not only Tom.
I don't like a lot of them, to be fair.
You don't. Okay.
Yeah, I don't like Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, I don't either. At least his doctrine of God. I think he's wise on a lot of things, but not when it comes to God. But I do think even people who agree with you will admit that a more typical reading of Scripture supports my view better than yours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably so.
I think one of the big questions that I kept asking myself when I was watching the Minority Report last night again is a question that I guess I kind of pose for the three of you, and that's the question of moral responsibility. And the film asks it, you know, if these precogs are seeing something that's going to happen in the future, it hasn't yet happened, and the police arrive before the murder occurs, is the person who was going to do the murder, at least what the precog said they were going to do, is that person genuinely morally responsible? We normally think a person isn't morally responsible for some action unless that person actually does the action. But in this case, in the Minority Report, there's so much trust that the precogs know what's going to happen in advance that they make the assumption that the person not only would have done it, but that would have doing the action is the truth of the matter ontologically. That's a pretty big jump. It's a jump I think a lot of theologians want to make when they say that God foreknows from all eternity that the four of us are going to have this conversation right now, and yet we somehow freely do it, and we're somehow freely responsible. And if we sin in this, we somehow are responsible for that sin. But it seems weird to think that that we're guilty of something even before we've even done it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so Philip Dick and Steven Spielberg, I do believe, are Calvinist, which might have caused this problem.
Is that right? Okay.
Maybe. That's what it seems like from the movie.
From the movie. I guess so.
But I do think it's interesting because they convince at least all of Washington, D.C. and then the world, or at least the country, they all operate on the supposition that the future is set in stone until John Anderton proves otherwise.
Yeah.
So,
I can understand the attraction of it because, and this was the thing I was asking myself last night. I was asking myself about my own theology. People were quite willing not only to set aside their quibbles about free will when it comes to the murder, but also set aside any quibbles they might have about having these three precog humans laying in vats all day thinking about the future. I mean, there's a kind of moral question there. They were willing to set aside those kind of qualms and squeamishness for the sake of preventing future murders. And I think that's a really big question. To what degree are we willing to sacrifice people's freedom and rights about what they choose to do with themselves for the sake of solving some murder?
Well, I think it's a better question if we ask it more personally. Like, the four of us, would we go spend the rest of our lives in a vat to prevent every future murder forever? I think I might.
Yeah.
But that assumes that the precogs were there voluntarily, which they weren't.
Yeah. Kind of hard. Yeah, movie doesn't settle that clearly, but I think I'm with you. They don't seem like they were there voluntarily.
Yeah, Agatha got manipulated into it at least, and they don't really cover the other two. They know, we know their lab experiments.
Maybe, can I change your question slightly, TJ?
Mm-hmm.
I'll still keep it personal. Would you ask your partner to spend the rest of their lives in a vat to prevent the murders of other people? Would you ask someone else to sacrifice their, you know, freedom and integrity mm-hmm. to prevent murders.
Right. And that's the reason that I framed mine in that way, because I think yeah. that is what most people in the world of Minority Report are assuming, that they volunteered for that.
Yeah.
And that makes it easier to set yeah. aside the moral quandary. It's like, oh, well, I'm sure they volunteered that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and a lot of other sci-fi, I think particularly today and in the last maybe 10 years or so, has asked similar questions. So me and TJ and Christian, another host of the show, did an episode on The Last of Us earlier this year. And in the first game of the first season, it very much poses this question of, you know, the main character is not willing to give up his adopted daughter to potentially save the world. And even though she would have granted him the freedom to do so, and it does raise such these questions. It's like, what are we more desperate to hold on to our individuality, our own needs, or are we willing to give up things for, you know, quote unquote, the greater good? There's a lot, I think, of that DNA in this movie as well. I don't know if I have a good, like, a lot of these questions, I don't know if I have a good answer to. It's honestly something I don't have to really pause and reflect on. But I think, too, we are, you know, we're getting into more uncertainty in the world as technologies are shifting. And, you know, if this movie takes place in 2054, we're in 2025. And a lot of concepts that we've seen in sci-fi movies for the past 20 years or more, you know, are coming more to fruition, particularly with AI. And, you know, these questions are being raised. So if we had this kind of technology in the future, there, like you said, Tom, I think there is definitely an appeal there, because it's like you see how much horrendous violence happens in the world today. And if you had a potential anecdote to that, would you sacrifice potentially some freedom and some sense of notion in order to make the world safer? Because movie really does tackle that at the beginning when they show that montage of people who, you know, because that's, well, the other thing I didn't mention in the plot summary is, in this, since pre-crime started in this world, the city has not had a murder in 6 years. And so you know, shows that, like, you know, despite the, you know, really shady origins of this division and this experiment, and there were horrible things done to the precogs, you know, there's like, it still raises that question of, like, was it worth it? Because there is certainly an appeal there of a world without murder. And so, you know, I don't think there's an easy answer here to definitively say what we would do in those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question, I think if I couldn't ask my partner to do that, but if they came to me and said they wanted to do that, then I would probably let them.
Yeah. And I like that you earlier said you would do that if you knew that you're laying in the vat and seeing these visions, even the painful as it is, would, if not totally eliminate, at least highly reduce the number of murders in the future, you'd do that. So that, you know, that makes me think of TJ. Here's a segment of our episode for us. Who's morally superior, TJ or Jesus of Nazareth? Let's say Jesus is divine and knows the future. And Jesus knows that going to the cross means that people are going to find salvation. Maybe everyone, maybe just some, but somehow Jesus knows that a good portion of the planet is going to find salvation because he dies. And TJ knows if he's in the vat looking at the films of future murders, he's going to prevent some, but not all. I would say if the number of people that Jesus could potentially save is far, far greater than TJ, given that TJ just started living just now. And mm-hmm. presumably, if Jesus is divine, Jesus has all time or whatever. So you can make a good argument that TJ is actually morally superior to Jesus of Nazareth. What do you think of that?
I think Josh and Christian would take that stance and run with it to introduce me on this show.
Good, good.
A lot.
More loving than Jesus.
Yeah, but I would say probably Jesus of Nazareth, because he did it. Mine's hypothetical.
All right.
For now, at least. But we'll see. Maybe that's the form that he'll come back in, is as a precog.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Mm-hmm. So it is, Andy.
I just, you know, that we've gone some places. I did not see any of this coming. But it's felt like we hit maybe a lull in that direction. So maybe I can nudge us in a little bit of a different direction. And since we've gotten fairly theological and biblical here, maybe we'll stay in that vein. Right. So one of the interesting things about the precog visions is that while they are literal, right, they are presented in the form of essentially video footage, right? The somehow they can extract video footage from these folks' minds. There's a lot of interpretation or exploration that needs to go into figuring out what's actually being seen, right? And the probably the most notable point is in the precog vision of the murder that Tom Cruise's character is going to commit. There appears to be a third man in the room in the vision, and probably an intentional nod to the film by that name as well. And but it eventually comes out that that's actually a billboard of a man across the street or across the way from the building. And just the trick of scale and forced perspective makes it look like he's the right size to be a person in the room, but it's actually, you know, a many feet tall billboard across the street. So yeah, so we have these little visions, but they're not necessarily straightforward to understand, which kind of, to me, rhymes a little bit with certainly prophecy and other storytelling forms where, you know, the trick that the devil plays or the prophet plays or the oracle plays is that, you know, the prophecy will come true, but you misunderstood it. And so there's some twist in the narrative that the hero or whomever doesn't quite get that. Maybe there's an element of, you know, there's obviously an element of interpretation to scriptural prophecy and so forth. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to put that on the table. I could have maybe formed that in the better as a question, but I'd love to hear folks' takes on those issues.
I'll start. Yeah, I think you raise something that's disanalogous to the theological question of God knowing the future and being able to provide a revelation of what that future is. Because as you rightly say, the revelation provided by the precogs in the movie is ambiguous, requires a great deal of interpretation from Tom Cruise and others. And while that may sound parallel to, let's say, revelation we find in scripture having multiple interpretations, or revelations that people allegedly have from mystical experiences, not necessarily aligning with the mystical experience of others, the big difference I see is that most theologians have thought that God is omnipotent. And God, unlike the precogs, could guarantee, at least an omnipotent God could guarantee, that we have an unambiguous revelation, a crystal clear revelation. And of course, that's what some people think they get with scripture, or they think they get that from the church, or they think they get that from their personal mystical experience. But I have lots of doubts that anyone gets any unambiguous revelation. So that's one of the differences. God of traditional theism is omnipotent and could make the revelations crystal clear. The precogs and the Minority Report apparently don't have that ability.
Part of it is just it adds to really good storytelling here in the movie because, they're the multiple angles here. Because I also know it was funny too. This is kind of a side note, but I remember a screenwriting class in college where we actually looked at the pitch for this film, and the professor actually criticized the climax I was talking about earlier, where it goes into how Max von Sydow's character was behind all this and the corruption, and it felt like kind of like the story ends with, you know, when Tom Cruise's character decides to not kill the man before he knows that he was a fake and he wasn't the guy who kidnapped his son.
Hey, podcast fam. Want to stay even more connected with the show? We've got you covered. Check us out on Instagram and Blue Sky, where we're posting exclusive content and bonus videos and fun updates that you won't get anywhere else. From sneak previews of upcoming episodes to bonus content, our social accounts are the best way to keep the conversation going. Plus, it's a great spot for you to interact with other listeners and share your thoughts. We love hearing from you. When you follow us, it helps us grow and continue bringing you the content that you love. Whether it's a funny poll, a quick clip from today's episodes, or just random thoughts, you'll feel more plugged into everything we're doing. So go ahead and hit that follow button on Instagram and Blue Sky. It's one more way to be a part of the show and keep the good vibes flowing. Thanks for being a part of the family, and we can't wait to see you there.
Bye. You know, all of those elements really help enhance the film in terms of, you know, providing like, oh, the precog's vision is not fully, you know, accurate. And I do that. I mean, everything you're talking about here, I'm thinking just to back all of my theological upbringing and, you know, where I am now, how it's changed drastically. I grew up in a very fundamentalist church, and then my views have changed a lot over the years. And I did InterVarsity in college, and I'm now at a progressive a church now that I really love, and I do this podcast. But my church is doing I just finished a series on Revelation, and I, you know, growing up, I was always taught to view it as very literal, when in fact, like, for a lot, I think this is my view at least, that a lot of the kind of prophets in scripture that have these visions, it's not fully, I would say, linear and accurate. A lot of it is sort of metaphorical interpretations that can still produce truth there, but it's not that, oh, all of these images are going to be things we actually see happen in a literal sense. And I think there's a connection here to this movie in that sense, like how, so I think precogs and prophets in scripture could have a parallel there.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do think, however, the prophets in the Bible do still benefit from it already having happened. In most cases, and not being written about until after the fact. That's not really relevant, but it feels a little unfair to compare them to the precogs, because, you know.
I mean, yeah, I'm not saying exactly. I just wonder if, like, in that sense of, like, particularly Revelation, like, with stuff that, you know, like, you know, looking at end times and apocalyptic visions, you know, how much of that is these literal images they saw, or is it, you know, are our minds not fully able to grasp that? You know what I mean? So not saying they're exactly alike, but I just wonder if there is a kind of connect, you know, anything right. We can connect it in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a point of clarification to TJ on this? Mm-hmm. When you said that the biblical prophets were talking about something that's already happened, did you mean that it's already happened in God's time, like maybe in the future, but it's already happened for God's perspective? Or did you mean it happened in the past and people are writing as if it's in the future, but they're actually looking at things historically rather than
from the author's perspective?
So the author is saying, you know, this is going to happen,
prophesied, and this
but
is...
they already knew it was happening. It happened. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I could see the other side of that. I could see someone who has your view that somehow God knows the future and the future is settled. Someone could say, okay, the prophets of scripture are given a revelation from God about events that are already, have already, quote, happened in God's time, but not right. yet in our time, but God gives them that knowledge. And I reject that view, but that right. would be plausible on your view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I think is how prophecy would work with that view. That's, okay. That's just kind of, yeah, he already knows it happened. So that's how he was able to tell you about it. I think it'd be interesting to discuss a stance wherein God is simply at the end of time and able to come back to voice his thoughts and, you know, give his qualms. And maybe more plausibly that way, you could believe in free will. Maybe not.
One of the common objections to my view says something like this. Yes, God knows the future, but God's knowing the future doesn't force me to make one decision or another. Mm-hmm. Knowledge doesn't force. That's a very common response. Now, that's, they're responding to a view that's not mine, but they interpret me as saying that. But what I'm saying is that it's not that God's alleged knowledge of the future somehow forces us to do one thing or another and we're not free. I'm saying God could only be absolutely certain about the future if the future were settled, fixed, determined. And if this future's settled, fixed, and determined, that's incompatible with us choosing amongst live options. There's a subtle distinction there, but I think it's a pretty important.
It is. It makes a huge difference. But
I think this also, actually, I want to call back to something I said at the very beginning. This notion of seeing the future, I think, is crucial. It's crucial for the Minority Report, and it's crucial for many theologians who think that God knows the future. And I love the fact that, the cover of the movie that you had up there one time shows the, you know, Tom Cruise figure with the bandage over his eyes. And part of this, part of the thing is his eyes are taken out, so he's not recognized. If I was writing the movie, I would have done some stuff with that in terms of foreknowledge and seeing things like, you know, if like, for instance, maybe having Agatha's eyes, Agatha, that's the one that's the Greek argument. Yeah.
Yeah.
What if we took out her eyes and decided, you know, if that made a difference? Does she actually need physical eyes to see things? Anyway.
Interesting musings. Definitely something I thought about. It's like, man, what if you got a precog's eyes?
Yeah.
What would happen?
Part of my criticism of the classical view that God sees the future is that it seems to suggest God has actual eyes. And I mean, unless you're a Mormon, most theists don't think God has a body and therefore doesn't have actual eyes. So that creates some real problems. I happen to think God's knowledge doesn't come from divine seeing, but comes from God as a feeler. That God feels causally everything that happens in the present. And that, I think, also, what's the right word? Given my emphasis upon love and real relationality, that fits nicely with a feeling kind of God, because a God who feels is, you know, intimately related and has real interactions, where you can more easily imagine a God who sees sort of standing at a distance from history and seeing things happening. I think maybe I said this on your show before, TJ, but I think it bears repeating here. John Calvin thought of God as the God who sees all of history all at once. And to illustrate that for his readers, he said, imagine that God hikes or climbs to the top of a church bell tower in the middle of a town. And from this height, looks down at the street below and sees a parade going through the streets. Now, from this perspective, if he's high enough in the bell tower in the church, he could see the beginning of the parade and the end of the parade all in one glance. Calvin said, that's how God sees history. God sees it all in one glance. My view is that God is not in the bell tower. God's actually in the parade. And as one in the parade, God feels what's happening moment by moment in the action of history, as opposed to standing outside of it and looking at it.
Right. And I think that is the issue that comes about with between you, your view and most people, is that most people subconsciously think of God as being outside of time.
Yep.
Because it's just not something that a lot of people think about.
I think that's right.
Which I agree. I personally think God sits outside of time.
Yeah.
Or maybe now I think he sits at the end of time. I kind of like that view. I might try to support that in the future. I don't know. Now that I've said it out loud, it sounds kind of cool, but that's for later thinking.
The downside of that view is that most people want to say God was there at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And if you have God only at the end, then how do you think of God creating at the beginning?
Well, it's a lot easier to go backwards than forwards. Everyone knows that. That's why all the movies are about going to the past.
I love it.
Yeah.
Hey, Andy, can I say one of my favorite scenes is, because I think it kind of relates to this, but two favorite scenes in this movie. One is just more of an action sequence that introduces some of the sci-fi elements, and that's when John is on the run after he's trying to clear his name, and he gets chased by his fellow officers, and one of the devices they have is called a six stick, where they use to basically cause someone to immediately gag. I always like, I mean, especially when I saw this in middle high school, I thought that was kind of hilarious, but also it was a, you know, really brilliant concept here. But that was one of my favorite, I love that action sequence, but one of my favorite more emotional sequences in the film that ties a lot into these ideas is toward the end when Agatha, after she's been rescued, she's sitting with John and his wife, and she has this vision of, I think, what John's son could have been if he had, right, like the life he could have had growing up, and if he had never, if the incident and when he went missing never happened, if he'd grown up, had a normal life, gone to college, gotten married, all these things. And it's this really beautiful vision she has. And I think that moment really brings some closure to John and his wife, because they've been trying to wrestle with and escape this tragedy for so long. And now they're able to relinquish that pain and suffering. And, you know, and that was just a really beautiful moment of the film.
And it is also raises another question, because it shows us that a precog can see futures that can't exist.
Exactly.
I think that would have been a perfect place to have their son be the next Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. In the
why
visions.
Make the kid have this beautiful life? You know, why not have the kid
make
have
him
this
awful
crappy life and be a horrible person? Because then you could say, well, maybe that death was okay after all. You know, like some people say when they say, you know, well, she died too early. Well, God knew that she was going to be horrible in the future, and that's why God took her. You know, that kind of an argument.
Tom
making this like an Ari Aster movie. Screw the Spielberg stuff. He's right. Rewriting it as Ari Aster.
I do agree, though. The action scenes, we didn't talk about them a lot, but they're pretty entertaining. I feel like they focus a lot more on like the subtle humor in the action sequences. Like Tom Cruise jumps on a dude with a jetpack. That's just funny. He's like, he's riding a dude on a jetpack.
It's pretty hilarious. I still think this movie very much holds up visually, because like we were talking earlier, this was the age of the digital revolution, and many critics, I went back and read Ebert's review of this movie earlier, and he had mentioned in that, you know, earlier I criticized movies like Attack of the Clones or the first Spider-Man for being too reliant on CG over story, which like to an extent I could do that maybe a little more with Attack of the Clones, but regardless, like this one, yeah, it utilizes effects well, and they do still really hold up, you know, decades later. I think it's impressive.
For like a point of reference, the Scorpion King came out the same year,
right,
so doesn't that look awful?
Oh, absolutely. You had plenty of filmmakers who, you know, felt obligation to utilize this technology, but really didn't know how to make it. And Spielberg has always been a filmmaker who, you know, adapts as the technologies and film changes, but he's always using them as tools to enhance the story, not to make them the sole focus.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to bully the Scorpion King anymore, but Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest came out 2 years after this, 3 years after this.
Yeah, about around there.
Still holds up visually today. And
right. Yep.
Way more CGI reliant.
Let's see. Pirates 1 4 years. Was, yeah, exactly. Because the Curse Black Pearl was 03. So, yeah.
But
absolutely. It is fascinating to see which ones still hold up today and which ones look awful.
Yeah.
Well, hey, guys, I'm getting a text from my wife saying it's time for me to come to dinner.
All right. Well, I was looking for a good place to bring this to a close, and that seems like the spot to do it.
We can blame my wife.
We will thank your wife for providing us with that opportunity to bless everyone with some more time to do as their free will leads them.
And God's not sure what they're going to do.
All right. I will remind folks that we're going to have a bonus question. If Tom needs to go, then Kevin and TJ and I will tackle that for a couple minutes after this main recording is done. We're going to be talking about, and TJ has already kind of spoiled a little bit of his thoughts, but we'll talk about the technology that the movie predicts and what it seems to be getting right and wrong. Does anybody real quickly have a recommendation of something that they would like to share with our listeners, a book, movie, anything. Tom, if there's something you want to plug, something you've written or something you got coming up that you'd like to encourage people to check out, this is a good spot to do it.
Well, maybe I'll just mention something I've already mentioned, which is the Substack that I have going on this Systematic Theology of Love. If there's anybody interested in that, I'd love to have them make some comments and suggestions on how I might improve it.
Excellent.
I think Ex Machina is a great companion piece to this film. It also raises up a lot of really interesting ideas. Alex Garland, yeah, that, I mean, I still think it's Alex Garland, probably his best film. And that one just has a lot of really interesting ideas. It's a great sci-fi film as well. Not as much of an action film, but definitely check that one out if you haven't seen it.
I'm going to have to recommend Absolution by Jeff Vandermeer. I just finished it the other day. It is the fourth book in the Southern Reach trilogy, used to be. But it is, if you've seen the movie Annihilation, it is the fourth book in that series, which is
that's right. Okay,
so good.
That's good, because Alex Garland directed Annihilation as well.
Yeah, he did a great job. And it was really interesting because he directed it after he read the first book. And then they were like, we should make a movie out of this. And the other two books came out later that year, and they still just didn't want to wait. They started production pretty much immediately after he finished the first one. But definitely check it out. I think it's a really good wrap to the story, and it answers a lot of questions, and it introduces just enough questions to be a great read, and it's still short like the others. So check out Absolution by Jeff Vandermeer.
And I'll throw out there Fantastic Four, number 33 from the Ryan North run on Fantastic Four, has a fun and heartstring-tugging time loop story that I think fits a little bit in with the themes of Minority Report. So you can check that out. Apologies that we ran a little bit long such that Tom had to go, but we thank him for having been here. And definitely check out his Substack. That's probably worthwhile beyond my silly comic book recommendations.
Yeah, there's a lot to read there.
Yes. I'll say again, please remember to like, subscribe, rate, review, all the good things that you can do on all the places. We really appreciate that. It helps everybody out a lot. Thank you to the appropriately named Jonathan Augustine for his financial support. And you too can get your own shout out by supporting us for $5 a month on that new Fourth Wall site, where you can also get the bonus content, buy merch, leave one-time or continuing a financial gift as well. And so TJ, Kevin, thank you also for being here, being part of a fun and wide-ranging conversation. And we will now sign off and ask you to remember that if you're going to geek, please do it systematically. Thanks.
Hey friends, it's your pal Will Rose here, and let me break the fourth wall a moment and look directly at you through the camera or speak directly to you in your earbuds. Yep, I'm talking to you, Susie. You too, Chad. You can now support Systematic Geekology on Fourth Wall. That's a website. You'll find all of our episodes, incredible merch like shirts and hoodies and mugs. Chad, I would love to see you in one of those shirts out in the wild.
You get bonus episodes. We answer bonus questions. We have special shout outs. We have certain episodes that you pick. So you help us create and curate the content that we put out for the world to hear. You even get free merch.
And you can support the show at different levels. You could join at the free level. Yep, we love free members, free support. Join it. Or you could become a sidekick for as little as $5 a month. You could join the elves and dwarves for $10 a month. You could become a wizard for $15 a month, or you could go to divinity school and become a cleric for $20 a month. And that's way cheaper than going to seminary, believe me. Or at $25 a month, you could become a superhero. And let me just say, we love all of our listeners, whether you support us at the free level or the superhero level. We love you. We love geeking out with you. Like, support, share the show. Love you.
Hello, Systematic Geekology listeners. This is Kevin here. Just want to give a brief ad for some of the other podcasts in our Anna Zowel podcast network.
First of all, off is Let Nothing Move You by Christian Ashley, in which Christian goes through the Bible one chapter at a time and gives his thoughts there. There is also The Bible After Hours, which is a more progressive take on the Bible that tries to challenge the status quo with satire and looks at theology. The host uses the pseudonym, The Foulmouth Preacher. And as a bonus, Joshua Knoll does the voices for this one. So definitely check that one out. And also, And We'll Laugh About That Later is the newest podcast that our own Will Rose is starting, where he will interview friends about a story they had that wasn't funny at the time, but that they laugh about now. So definitely check out these shows and subscribe to us wherever you get your pods. Thank you very much.